4:09, and gives it to my mother. "Can you read the highlighted passage?" My mother lifts the paper. A 17-year-old juvenile female stated that Jacob Hunt walked up to her, slammed her against the lockers, and pinned her by her throat until he was forcibly removed by a staff member. "Are you suggesting that's not violent behavior?" Helen Sharp asks. "Even if we leave now, we will be 11 minutes late for Crime Busters." "Jacob felt cornered," my mother says. "I'm not asking you how Jacob felt. The only person who knows how Jacob felt is Jacob. What I'm asking you is whether you would categorize slamming a young woman up against a locker and pinning her by her neck as violent behavior." "This victim," my mother says, her voice hot, "is the same charming girl who said that if Jacob told his math teacher to go fuck himself, she'd be his friend." One of the ladies on the jury shakes her head. "I wonder if it's because of what Mimi did, or because my mother said fuck." Once, during a ratings sweeps episode of Crime Busters that was aired live, like a Broadway show, an extra dropped a hammer on his foot and said the F-bomb, and as a result, the network was fined. The censors bleeped it, but for a while, it was circulating on YouTube in its full blue glory. Crime Busters is airing in 13 minutes. Oliver nudges my shoulder. "What is the matter with you? Stop it. You look crazy." I look down. I'm slapping my hand hard against the side of my leg. I haven't even realized I'm doing it. But now I'm even more confused. I thought I was supposed to look crazy. "So, this girl was mean to Jacob. I think we can both agree on that, right?" "Yes." "But that doesn't negate the fact that he was violent toward her." "What he did was just," my mother replies. "So, Ms. Hunt, you're saying that if a young woman says something to Jacob that isn't very nice or that hurts his feelings, he's justified in acting violent toward her?" My mother's eyes flash, like they always do before she gets really, really, really mad. "Don't put words in my mouth. I'm saying that my son is kind and sensitive and that he wouldn't intentionally hurt a fly." "You've heard the evidence in this case. Are you aware that Jacob argued with Jess 2 days before she was last seen alive?" "That's different. Were you there, Ms. Hunt?" "No." Right now is the last commercial for Law & Order SVU, which is the show that is on the network before Crime Busters. There will be 4 30-second spots and then the opening bars of music. I close my eyes and start to hum. "You said that one of the behaviors that's indicative of Jacob's Asperger's is that he gets uncomfortable around people or circumstances he doesn't know, correct?" "Yes." "And that he sometimes withdraws from you?" "Yes," my mother says. "That he has a hard time expressing his feelings to you verbally?" "Yes." "It's the one where a child falls into a well, and when Rihanna is lowered in to save the little boy, she shines a flashlight, and there is a complete human skeleton. There are pearls, there are diamonds, but the bones belong to a man. It's an heiress who disappeared in the 60s, and at the end, you learn she was actually a he. Wouldn't you agree, Ms. Hunt, that your other son, Theo, exhibits every single one of these behaviors from time to time? In fact, that every teenager on the planet exhibits them?" "I wouldn't exactly." "Does that make Theo insane too?" "It's 4:32, it's 4:32, it's 4:32. "Can we please leave now?" I say. But the words are as loose as molasses, and they don't sound right. And everyone is moving slowly and slurring their words too, when I stand up to get their attention. "Mr. Bond, control your client," I hear, and Oliver grabs my arm and yanks me off my feet. The prosecutor's lips pull back from her teeth like a smile, but it's not a smile. "Ms. Hunt, you were the one who contacted the police when you saw Jacob's quilt on the news broadcast. Isn't that true?" "Yes," my mother whispers. You did it because you believed your son had killed Jess Ogilvy, didn't you? She shakes her head 434 and doesn't answer. Ms. Hunt, you thought your own son had committed murder. Isn't that true? The lawyer says with a voice that's a hammer. Ms. Hunt, 435, answer the no question. Suddenly, the room goes still, like the air between the beats of a bird's wings, and I can hear everything rewinding in my head. Control your client. You look crazy. The hardest thing to hear is the truth. I stare at my mother, right into her eyes, and feel the fingernails on the chalkboard of my brain and belly. I can see the chambers of her heart, and the ruby cells of her blood, and the twisting winds of her thoughts. Oh, Jacob, I hear, instant replay. What did you do? I know what she's going to say a minute before she says it, and I can't let her do that. Then, I remember the prosecutor's words, the only person who knows how Jacob felt is Jacob. Stop! I yell as loud as I can. Judge, Oliver says, I think we need to adjourn for the day. I get to my feet again. Stop! My mother comes out of her seat on the witness stand. Jacob, it's okay. Your Honor, the witness has not answered the question. I cover my ears with my hands because they are all so loud and the words are bouncing off the walls and the floor, and I stand on my chair and then on the table, and finally I jump right into the middle of the space in front of the judge, where my mother is already reaching for me. But before I can touch her, I am on the floor, and the bailiff has his knee in my back, and the judge and jury are scrambling, and suddenly there is quiet and calm and no more wait, and a voice I know. You're okay, buddy, Detective Mattson says. He reaches out a hand, and he helps me to my feet. Once at a fair, Theo and I went into a hall of mirrors. We got separated. Or maybe Theo just left me behind. But I found myself walking into walls and looking around corners that didn't really exist. And finally, I sat down on the floor and closed my eyes. That's what I want to do now, with everyone staring at me. Just like then. There's no way out that I can foresee. You're okay, Detective Mattson repeats, and he leads the way.
Rich. Most of the time, if a town cop comes into the sheriff's domain, a pissing contest ensues. They don't want me telling them how to run their outfit any more than I want them screwing up one of my crime scenes. But with Jacob on the loose in the courtroom, they probably would have welcomed the National Guard's help if it had been available. And when I hop over the bar and grab Jacob, everyone else steps away and lets me, as if I actually know what I'm doing. His head is bobbing up and down as if he's having a conversation with himself, and one of his hands makes a weird stretching motion against his leg. But at least he isn't yelling anymore. I walk Jacob into a holding cell. He turns away from me, shoulders pressed to the bars. You okay? I ask. But he doesn't answer. I lean against the bars from the outside of the cell so that we are practically back to back. There was a guy once who killed himself in a holding cell in Swanton, I say, as if this is ordinary conversation. The officers booked him and left him there to sleep off a good drunk. He was standing like you, but with his arms crossed, wearing a flannel shirt, button down. Security camera on him the whole time. You probably can't guess how he did it. At first, Jacob doesn't answer. Then he turns his head slightly. He made a noose by tying the arms of the shirt around his neck, he answers. So it looked like he was standing up against the bars on the security camera, but actually he'd already hanged himself. A laugh barks out of me. God damn it, kid, you're really good. Jacob pivots, so that he's facing me.
I shouldn't be talking to you.
Probably not. I stare at him.
Why did you leave the quilt? You know better than that.
He hesitates.
Of course I left the quilt. How else would anyone know that I was the one who set this all up? You still missed the teabag.
Immediately, I know he is talking about the evidence at Jess Ogilvie's house. It was in the sink. We didn't get any prints off the mug.
Jess was allergic to mango, Jacob says. And me? I hate the taste.
He had been too thorough. Rather than forgetting to erase this evidence, he'd left it on purpose as a test. I stare at Jacob, wondering what he's trying to tell me.
But other than that, he says, smiling, you got it right.
Oliver. Helen and I stand in front of Judge Cuttings like recalcitrant schoolchildren. I don't ever want to see that happen again, Mr. Bond, he says. I don't care if you have to medicate him. Either you keep your client under control for the remainder of this trial, or I'm going to have him handcuffed. Your Honor, Helen says, how is the state supposed to have a fair trial when we have a circus sideshow going on every 15 minutes? You know she's right, Counselor, the judge replies. I'm going to ask for a mistrial, Your Honor, I say. You can't when it's your client causing the problems, Mr. Bond. Surely you know that. Right, I mutter. If there are any motions you two want to make, think hard before you make them. Mr. Bond, I will hear you with warning before we start. I hurry out of chambers before Helen can say anything that infuriates me even more. And then, just when I think things can't get any worse, I find Rich Matson chatting up my client. I was just keeping him company until you got here, Matson explains. Yeah, I bet. He ignores me, turning to Jacob instead. Hey, the detective says. Good luck. I wait until I can't hear his footsteps anymore. What the hell was that all about? Nothing. We were talking about cases. Oh, great. Because that was such a good idea the last time you two sat down for a chat. I fold my arms. Listen, Jacob, you need to straighten out. If you don't behave, you're going to jail. Period. If I don't behave, he says, schwing. You can't possibly be old enough to remember Wayne's World. And regardless, I'm not the one who's the defendant. I'm totally serious, Jacob. If you pull another stunt like that, the prosecution is going to throw your ass in jail or else declare a mistrial. And that means doing this all over again. You promised that we'd adjourn at 4 o'clock. You're right. But in a courtroom, the judge is God. And God wanted to stay late. So I don't care if we're here till 4 in the morning or if Judge Cuttings announces that we're all going to get up and do the hokey pokey. You are going to park your butt in that chair next to me and not say a damn thing. Will you tell the jury why I did it? Jacob asks. Why did you do it? I knew better than to ask that. But at this point, I am not thinking of perjury. I am thinking that Jacob and I need to be on the same page, once and for all. Because I couldn't leave her, he says, as if this should be obvious. My jaw drops. Before I can ask another question, did she spurn you? Did you try to kiss her and did she struggle too much? Did you hold her too close and suffocate her accidentally? A bailiff comes into the holding cell area. They're ready for you. I motion to the bailiff to open the cell. We are the last ones into the courtroom, with the exception of the judge and jury. Emma's eyes go straight to her son. Is everything okay? But before I can fill her in, the jury files in and the judge returns. Counsel, he says, settling himself on the bench. Approach. Helen and I move closer. Mr. Bond, have you spoken with your client? Yes, Your Honor, and there will be no further outbursts. I can hardly contain myself, Judge Cuttings says. You may continue then, knowing what I know now, that insanity defense is looking stronger and stronger. I just hope the jury got that message, loud and clear. The defense rests, I announce. What? Jacob explodes behind me. No, it doesn't. I close my eyes and start to count to 10, because I'm pretty sure it's not a good idea to kill your client in front of an entire jury. And then a paper airplane sails over my shoulder. It's one of Jacob's notes, which I unfold. I want to talk. I turn around. Absolutely not. Is there a problem, Mr. Bond? The judge asks. No, Your Honor, I reply at the same moment Jacob says, yes? Scrambling, I face the judge again. We need a sensory break. We've been in session for 10 seconds, Helen argues. Do you rest, Mr. Bond? Asks Judge Cuttings, or is there more? There's more, Jacob says. It's my turn to talk, and if I want to take the stand, you have to let me. You're not taking the stand, Emma insists. You, Ms. Hunt, do not have leave to speak. Am I the only person here who knows we're in a court of law? Judge Cuttings roars. Mr. Bond, put on your final witness. I'd like a brief recess. I bet you would. I'd like to be in Nevis instead of here, but neither one of us is going to get what we want, the judge snaps. Shaking my head, I walk Jacob to the witness stand. I am so angry I can barely see straight. Jacob will tell the jury the truth, like he's told me, and dig his own grave. If not with the substance of what he says, then with the style. No matter what's been said up to this point, no matter what's been said by the witnesses, all the jury is going to remember is this awkward boy who speaks in bursts of words and fidgets and doesn't register appropriate emotion and can't look them in the eye. All traditional expressions of guilt. It doesn't matter what Jacob says. His demeanor will convict him before he even opens his mouth. I open the gate for him so that he can step inside. It's your funeral, I murmur. No, Jacob says. It's my trial. I can tell the moment he realizes that this wasn't such a great idea. He's been sworn in, and he swallows hard. His eyes are wide and dart all over the courtroom. Tell me what happens when you get nervous, Jacob, I say. He licks his lips. I walk on my toes or bounce. Sometimes I flap or talk too fast or laugh even though it's not funny. Are you nervous now? Yes. Why? He pulls his lips back in a smile. Because everyone's looking at me? Is that all? Also, the lights are too bright, and I don't know what you're going to say next. Whose goddamn fault is that? I think. Jacob, you told the court that you wanted to talk. Yes. What do you want to tell this jury? Jacob hesitates. The truth, he says.
Jacob. There's blood all over the floor, and she is lying in it. She doesn't answer even though I call her name. I know I need to move her, so I lift her up and take her into the hallway. And when I do, there's even more blood that comes from her nose and her mouth. I try not to think about the fact that I'm touching her body and she is naked. It isn't like in the movies where the girl is beautiful and the boy is backlit. It's just skin against skin, and I'm embarrassed for her because she doesn't even know she isn't wearing clothes. I don't want to get blood on the towels, so I wipe her face with toilet paper and flush it. There's underwear on the floor, and a bra and sweatpants and a shirt. I put the bra on first, and I know how because I watch HBO and have seen them being taken off. All I have to do is reverse it. The underwear I don't understand because there's writing on one side, and I don't know if it's the front or the back, so I just put it on her any which way. Then the shirt and the sweatpants, and finally socks and UGG boots, which are the hardest because she can't press down with her feet. I pick her up over my shoulder. She's heavier than I thought she would be, and try to get her down the stairs. There's a turn on the landing, and I trip over my feet, and we both fall. I land on top of her, and when I roll her over, her tooth is knocked out. I know it didn't hurt her, but it still makes me feel like I'm going to be sick. The bruises and the broken nose for some reason weren't nearly as bad as seeing her with that missing front tooth. I sit her up in an armchair. "Wait here," I say, and then I laugh out loud because she can't hear me. Upstairs, I mop up the blood with more toilet paper, the whole roll. It's still smeary and wet. In the laundry closet, I find bleach, and I pour it on the floor, and use another roll of toilet paper to dry it all off. It does cross my mind that I might get caught, and that's when I decide not to just clean up, but to make a crime scene that leads in a different direction. I pack a bag of extra clothes and take her toothbrush. I type a note and stick it in the mailbox. I put on a pair of boots too big to be hers and walk around outside, cut the screen, put the kitchen knife in the dishwasher, and turn on the quick cycle. I want to be obvious because Mark is not too smart. I make sure to wipe away the footprints on the porch and the driveway. Inside, I put the backpack on my shoulders and make sure I'm not forgetting anything. I know I should leave the stools knocked over and the CDs scattered on the living room floor, but I just can't. So I pick up the stools and the mail, and then I organize the CDs the way I think she would have liked them. I try to carry her into the woods, but she gets heavier with every step, so instead, after a while, I have to drag her. I want her to be somewhere where I know she won't have to sit in wind or rain or snow. I like the culvert because I can get to it from the highway instead of going past her house. I think about her even when I'm not here, even when I know the police are all looking, and I could so easily be distracted by tracking their progress or lack thereof. That's why when I come back to visit, I bring my quilt. It was something I always liked, and I think if she could talk, she would have been really proud of me for wrapping her in it. "Good job, Jacob," she would have said. "You're thinking of someone else for a change." Little did she know, that was all I was thinking about. When I'm done, the courtroom is so quiet I can hear the pop and hiss of the radiator and the building stretching its beams. I look at Oliver and at my mother. I expect them to be pretty pleased, because everything should make sense now. I can't read their faces, though, or the faces of the jury. One woman is crying, and I don't know if she's sad because I was talking about Jess, or because she's happy to finally know what really happened. I'm not nervous now. If you want to know, I've got so much adrenaline in my bloodstream, I could probably run to Bennington and back. I mean, holy cow! I've just outlined how I set up a crime scene with a dead body after successfully fooling the police into believing it was a kidnapping attempt. I've connected all the dots that the state raised as evidence in this trial. It's like the best episode of Crime Busters ever, and I'm the star. "Mr. Bond?" the judge prompts. Oliver clears his throat. He rests one hand on the railing of the witness stand, looking away from me. "All right, Jacob. You told us a lot about what you did after Jess's death, but you haven't told us about how she died." "There isn't much to tell," I say. Suddenly, I realize where I've seen that expression on everyone's face in this courtroom. It's the one on Mimi Scheck's face, and Mark McGuire's face, and everyone else who thinks that they have absolutely nothing in common with me. I start to get that burning sensation in my stomach, the one that comes when I realize too late I might have done something that actually wasn't such a great idea. And then Oliver throws me a lifeline. "Jacob, are you sorry for killing Jess?" I smile widely. "No," I say. "That's what I've been trying to tell you all along."
Oliver. Here's the bittersweet thing. Jacob has made himself look more insane than I ever could with a witness's testimony. Then again, he's also made himself look like a ruthless murderer. Jacob is once again sitting at the defense table, holding his mother's hand. Emma is white as a sheet, and I can't blame her. After listening to Jacob's testimony, a detailed description in his own words of how to clean up after a mess of your own making, I find myself in the same position. "Ladies and gentlemen," I begin, "there's been a lot of evidence produced here about how Jess Ogilvy died. We're not disputing that evidence. But if you've been paying attention at this trial, you also know that you can't judge this book by its cover. Jacob is a young man with Asperger's syndrome, a neurological disorder that precludes him from having empathy for others in the same way you or I might. When he talks about what he did with Jess's body and at Jess's residence, he doesn't see his involvement in a horrific murder. Instead, as you've heard, he takes pride in the fact that he set up a complete crime scene, a crime scene worthy of inclusion in a journal, just like an episode of Crime Busters. I'm not going to ask you to excuse him for Jess Ogilvy's death. We grieve with her parents for that loss and do not seek to diminish the tragedy in any way. However, I am going to ask you to take the information you've been given about Jacob and his disorder so that when you question whether he was criminally responsible at the time of Jess's death, whether he understood right from wrong in that moment the way you understand right from wrong, you will have no choice but to answer no." I walk toward the jury. Asperger's is a tough nut to crack. You've heard a lot about it these past few days, and I bet you've thought, so what? Not being comfortable in new situations, wanting to do things the same way every day, finding it hard to make new friends. These are struggles we've all faced from time to time. Yet, none of these traits impair our ability to make judgments, and none of us are on trial for murder. You might be thinking that Jacob doesn't fit your impression of a person with a diagnosable neurological disorder. He's smart. He doesn't look crazy in the colloquial sense of the word. So, how can you be certain that Asperger's syndrome is a valid neurological disorder, and not just the latest label du jour for a kid with problems? How can you be sure Asperger's provides an explanation of his behavior at the moment a crime was committed, instead of just a fancy legal excuse? I smile. Well, I offer an example from Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. In the 50s and 60s, the court was involved in deciding a number of obscenity cases. Since obscenity isn't protected under the First Amendment, they had to determine whether a series of pornographic films met the legal definition of obscenity, and so they'd screen them. Every week, on what was known as Obscenity Tuesday, the justices watched these films and rendered decisions. It was in Jacob Ellis v. Ohio that Justice Stewart became legendary in the legal field for saying that hardcore pornography was hard to define, but that, and I quote, "I know it when I see it." I turned to Jacob. "I know it when I see it," I repeat. You haven't just listened to experts and seen medical files and seen forensic evidence. You've also watched and heard Jacob. And based on that alone, it must be clear to you that he's not just a kid with a few personality quirks. He's a kid who doesn't communicate particularly well and whose thoughts are often jumbled. He talks in a monotone and doesn't show a great deal of emotion, even when it seems warranted. Yet, he was brave enough to stand up in front of you and try to defend himself against one of the most serious charges a young man like him could ever face. What he said, and how he said it, might have been upsetting to you. Shocking, even. But that's because a person with Asperger's, a person like Jacob, is not your typical witness. I didn't want my client to testify. I'll be honest with you. I didn't think that he could do it. When you're a witness in a trial, you have to practice saying things in a way that works to make your case. You have to present yourself in a manner that is sympathetic to the jury. And I knew Jacob could not and would not do that. Hell, I could barely get him to wear a tie here. I certainly couldn't make him express remorse or even sadness. I couldn't tell him what he should and shouldn't say in front of you. To Jacob, that would have been lying. And to Jacob, telling the truth is a rule that has to be followed. I look at the jurors. What you have here is a kid who isn't working the system because he's physically and psychologically incapable of working the system. He doesn't know how to play to your sympathies. He doesn't know what will help or hurt his chances of acquittal. He simply wanted to tell you his side of the story. So he did. And that's how you know that Jacob's not a criminal trying to squeak through a loophole. That's how you know that his Asperger's can, and did, and still does, impair his judgment at any given moment. Because any other defendant, any ordinary defendant, would have known better than to tell you what Jacob did. You and I know, ladies and gentlemen, that the legal system in America works very well if you happen to communicate a certain way, a way Jacob doesn't. And yet, everyone in this country is entitled to a fair trial. Even people who communicate differently from the way that works best in court. I take a deep breath. Maybe, for justice to be done then, in Jacob's case, we simply need people who are willing to listen a little more closely. As I take my seat again, Helen stands up. When I was a little girl, I remember asking my mother why, instead of saying toilet paper on the wrapper, it said bath tissue. And you know what my mom told me? You can call it whatever you want, but all the words in the world can't dress up what it is. This isn't a case about a young man who has a hard time holding a conversation or making friends or eating something other than blue jello on Wednesday. Friday, I mentally correct. Jacob reaches for his pencil and starts to write a note, but before he can, I pluck the pencil out of his hand and slip it into my coat pocket. It's a case about a boy who committed a cold-blooded murder, and then, using his brains and his fascination with crime scenes, tried to cover his tracks. I don't contest that Jacob has Asperger's syndrome. I don't expect any of you to contest it either. But that doesn't absolve him of responsibility for this brutal, vicious killing. You've heard from the crime scene investigators who went to the house and found traces of Jess's blood all over the bathroom floor. You've heard Jacob himself say that he washed it away with bleach and then flushed the toilet paper away. Why? Not because there's a rule about where toilet paper goes when you're done with it, but instead because he didn't want anyone to know he had cleaned up that mess. He told you, ladies and gentlemen, about how he set up that entire crime scene and how much thought he put into it. He deliberately tried to lead police down the wrong trail, to make them think Jess had been kidnapped. He slit the screen and used Mark McGuire's boots to leave footprints, to purposefully suggest that someone else was responsible for the crime. He dragged Jess's body the length of 3 football fields and left it outside so that it would be harder for people to find. And when he grew tired of playing his own little game of crime busters, he took Jess's cell phone and dialed 911. Why? Not because it was easier for him to interface with a dead body than a live one, but because it was all part of Jacob Hunt's perverse plan to selfishly discard Jess Ogilvie's life in order to allow him to play forensic detective. She faces the jury. Mr. Bond can call this whatever he wants, but that doesn't change what it is. A young man who committed a brutal murder and who actively, over a period of days, covered it up with careful clues to mislead the police. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the MO of a calculating killer. Not a kid with Asperger's syndrome.
Emma. From the archives of Auntie M. Dear Auntie M, what do you do if all signs point to the fact that the world as you know it is going to come to a crashing halt? Sincerely, Humpty Dumpty was pushed. Dear Humpty, help. Love, Auntie M. 3 days later, the jury is still deliberating. We've settled into a routine. In the morning, Oliver brings Thor over for breakfast. Jacob takes him into the yard to throw a ball, while Henry and Theo slowly animate themselves with coffee. Henry's been teaching Theo C-sharp programming to create his own computer game, which has fascinated Theo to no end. In the afternoons, Oliver and I play Scrabble, and every now and then Jacob will call out obscure, legitimate words from the couch where he's watching Crime Busters, Quaza. We don't turn on the news or read the paper, because all they talk about is Jacob. We're not allowed to leave the house for 2 reasons. Technically, Jacob is still under arrest, and we must be in a spot where we can get to the courthouse in 20 minutes when the jury returns. It's still strange to me to turn a corner in my own house and find Henry there. I expected him to leave by now, to come up with the excuse that one of his daughters has strep, or his wife has to visit a dying aunt. But Henry insists he's here until the verdict comes back. Our conversation is full of clichés, but at least it is a conversation. I'm making up for lost time, he says. Better late than never. We've become a family. An unorthodox one, and one cobbled together by someone else's tragedy. But after years of being the only parent in this house, I'll take what I can get. Later, while the boys are getting ready for bed, Oliver and I take Thor for a walk around the block before he goes back to his apartment over the pizza place. We talk about the horse that stepped on his ankle and broke it. We talk about how I used to want to be a rider. We talk about the trial. We don't talk about us. Is it good or bad if the jury can't reach a verdict?
Good, I think. It probably means someone's holding out on a conviction.
What happens next?
If Jacob's convicted, Oliver says, as Thor runs back and forth in front of us, lacing up the path, he'll go to prison. I don't know if it will be the same one he was in. If he's found not guilty by reason of insanity, the judge will probably want another psychiatric evaluation.
But then he'll come home?
I don't know, Oliver admits. We'll get Ava Newcomb and Dr. Murano to put together an outpatient treatment plan, but it depends on Judge Cuttings. He could weigh the fact that Jacob committed murder and decide that he can't ignore that and isolate him from the rest of the community.
He's told me this before, but it never seems to sink in.
in a state mental hospital, I finish. As we reach my driveway again, I stop walking, and Oliver stops too, his hands in the pockets of his jacket. I fought my whole life to have Jacob treated like ordinary kids in regular school with regular programming, I say. And now his only chance of staying out of jail means playing the Asperger's card. I honestly don't know what's going to happen, Oliver says. But it's better to be prepared. I haven't told Jacob yet. He looks down at his shoes. Maybe you should. As if we've conjured him, the door opens and Jacob stands in silhouette in his pajamas. I'm waiting for you to say goodnight, he tells me.
I'll be right there.
Jacob looks at Oliver, impatient.
Well? Well, what? Will you just kiss her goodbye already?
My jaw drops with surprise. Since my fight with Jacob, Oliver and I have been careful to steer clear of each other in his company. But now, Oliver takes me into his arms.
I don't have to be asked twice,
he says, and he presses his lips against mine. When Jacob was little, I used to sneak into his bedroom after midnight and sit on a rocking chair next to his bed so that I could watch him sleep. There was a wonderful magic brush that painted him when he was unconscious. In his bed, I couldn't tell that the hand curled under the covers was the same one that had stimmed fiercely that afternoon when a girl at the park came into the sandbox where he was happily playing alone. I couldn't tell that those eyes, closed, winced when I asked him to look right at me. I couldn't watch him, easy and relaxed in his dreams, and think this was the same boy who couldn't remember the sequence of words to ask the lunch lady for apple juice instead of milk. When Jacob slept, the slate was wiped clean, and he could have been any child, any ordinary child. Instead, during his waking hours, he was extraordinary. And that truly was the definition for him, outside the perimeter of the norm. At some point in the English language, that word had acquired positive connotations. Why hadn't Asperger's? You could say I was different. I had willingly traded my own future for Jacob's, giving up whatever fame or fortune I might have achieved in order to make sure his life was a better one. I had let every relationship slide, with the exception of the one I'd built with Jacob. I had made choices that other women wouldn't have made. At best, that made me a fierce, fighting mother. At worst, it made me single-minded. And yet, if I walked into a crowded room, people didn't mystically part from me as if there was an invisible magnetic field, a polarizing reaction between my body and theirs. People didn't turn to their friends and groan, "Oh God, save me, she's heading this way." People didn't roll their eyes behind my back when I was talking. Jacob might have acted strangely, but he'd never been cruel. He simply didn't have the self-awareness for it. Now, I sink down on that same chair I used to sit on years ago, and I watch Jacob sleep again. He isn't a child anymore. His face has the planes of that of an adult. His hands are strong and his shoulders sculpted. I reach out and brush his hair back from where it's fallen over his forehead. In his sleep, Jacob stirs. I don't know what kind of life I'd have had without Jacob, but I don't want to know. If he hadn't been autistic, I couldn't love him any more than I already do. And even if he is convicted, I couldn't love him any less. I lean down, just like I used to, and I kiss him on the forehead. It's the age-old, time-honored way for mothers to test for fever, to give a blessing, to say goodnight. So why does it feel like I'm saying goodbye?
Theo. My 16th birthday is today, but I'm not expecting much. We're still waiting, 6 days later, for the jury to reach a verdict. I'm guessing, actually, that my mother won't even remember, which is why I'm struck speechless when she yells, "Breakfast," and I come downstairs with my hair still wet from my shower, and there's a chocolate cake with a candle in it. Granted, it's Brown Thursday, and it's no doubt gluten-free, but beggars can't be choosers. "Happy birthday, Theo," my mother says, and she starts the round of singing. My dad, my brother, and Oliver all join in. I have a big, fat smile on my face. As far as I know, my father has never been to one of my birthday parties, unless you count the minute I was delivered in the hospital, and that wasn't really a party, I imagine. Was it worth it? A little voice inside me curls like the smoke from the candle. Was it worth all this to get a family like the ones you used to spy on? My mother puts her arm around my shoulders. "Make a wish, Theo," she says. A year ago, this is exactly what I would have wished for. What I did wish for, with or without the cake. But there's something in her voice, like a string made of steel, that suggests there's a right answer here. One collective heart's desire for all of us. Which just happens to rest in the hands of 12 jurors. I close my eyes and blow out the candle, and everyone claps. My mother starts to cut slices from the cake and gives me the first one. "Thanks," I say. "I hope you like it," my mother replies. "And I hope you like this." She hands me an envelope. Inside is a note, handwritten. "Your debt is paid." I think of my crazy trip to California to find my father, of how much money those tickets had cost, and for a second I can't talk. "But," she says, "if you do that again, I'll kill you." I laugh, and she wraps her arms around me from behind and kisses the top of my head. "Hey, there's more." My father hands me an envelope, which has a cheesy, "To my son" Hallmark card inside and $40. "You can start saving for a faster router," he says. "That's awesome." Then Oliver hands me a package wrapped in Bounty paper towels. "It was this or a pizza box," he explains. I shake it. "Is it a calzone?" "Give me a little credit here," Oliver says. I rip it open and find the Vermont driver's manual. "After this trial's over, I thought you and I could make an appointment at the DMV and finally get that learner's permit." I have to look down at the table, because if I don't, everyone's going to realize I'm totally about to cry. I remember how when I was little, my mother would read us these ridiculous fairy tales where frogs turned into princes and girls woke up from comas with a single kiss. I never bought into any of that crap. But who knows? Maybe I was wrong. Maybe a person's life can change in an instant after all. "Wait," Jacob says. Until now, he's been watching, his face bisected by a smile. And this is an improvement. At all my birthday parties growing up, the unwritten rule was that Jacob had to help me blow out the candles. It was easier to share my moment than to have him ruin the festivities with a meltdown. "I've got a present for you too, Theo." I don't think in all the years that I've been alive, Jacob's ever gotten me a present. I don't think he's ever gotten anyone a present, unless you count the perfume I pick out at CVS for Christmas and give to my mother after putting both my name and Jacob's on the tag. Giving gifts just isn't on my brother's radar. What's he got? Oliver murmurs as Jacob hightails it upstairs. I don't know, my mother answers. A minute later, Jacob's back. He's holding a stuffed duck he used to sleep with when he was small. Open it, he says, holding it out. I take it and turn it over in my hands. There's no wrapping, nothing to be opened. I say, laughing a little. How? Jacob turns the duck upside down and pulls on a loose thread. It unravels a little, and some of the stuffing comes out in a clump. I poke my finger into the hole and feel something smooth and hard. Is that where my Tupperware went? My mother says when I pull it out of the chest cavity of the duck. Inside, there's something I can't quite make out. I open the lid and find myself staring at a pink iPod Nano. Gingerly, I pick it up, knowing even before I turn it over that Jess Ogilvie's name is etched into the metal on the back. Where did you get that? My mother whispers, from somewhere on the other end of the vacuum I've fallen into. You wanted it, didn't you? Jacob says, still excited. You dropped it on the way out of our house that day. I can barely move my lips. What are you talking about? I already told you. I know you were there. I saw the tread from the bottom of your sneakers, the same ones I used here for my fake crime scene, and I knew you'd been taking other stuff from other houses. What? My mother says. I saw the video games in your room. Jacob beams at me. At Jess's, I cleaned up for you, so no one would know what you did. And it worked, Theo. No one ever found out that you killed her. My mother gasps. What the hell is going on? Oliver asks. I didn't kill her, I say. I didn't even know she lived there. I didn't think anyone was home. I was going to look around, maybe take a CD or two, but then I heard water running upstairs and I peeked in. She was naked. She was naked and she saw me. I freaked out and she got out of the shower and she slipped. She hit her face on the edge of the sink and that's when I ran. I was afraid she'd catch me. I can't breathe, and I'm sure that my heart's turned to clay in my chest. She was alive when I left in the bathroom, and then all of a sudden, the news says she's dead and her body's found outside. I knew I wasn't the one who moved her out there. Someone else had, someone who probably murdered her. I thought maybe she told Jacob about me when he came for his lesson. And they had a fight about it. And that Jacob, I don't know. I don't know what I thought. You didn't kill Jess, my mother says. I shake my head, numb. My mother looks at Jacob. And you didn't kill Jess. I just moved her body. He rolls his eyes. I've been telling you that the whole time. Jacob, Oliver asks, was Jess alive when you got to the house? No, but I saw that Theo had been there, so I did what was right. Why didn't you call your mother or an ambulance? My father asks. Why would you set up a crime scene to cover up for Theo? Jacob stares right at me. It hurts. It actually hurts. House rules, he says simply. Take care of your brother. He's the only one you've got. You have to do something, my mother says to Oliver. It's new evidence. Theo can testify. He might be implicated or charged with withholding. You have to do something, my mother repeats. Oliver is already reaching for his coat. Let's go, he says. Jacob and I are the last ones out of the kitchen. The cake is still sitting on the table, along with my other presents. It already looks like a museum exhibit, untouched. You'd never guess that 5 minutes ago, We were celebrating. Jacob. My brother turns around. I don't know what to say. He awkwardly pats my shoulder. Don't worry, Jacob replies. That happens to me all the time.
Jacob. Today is April 15th. It's the day in 1912 that the Titanic sank. It's the day in 1924 that Rand McNally published its first road atlas. It's the day in 1947 that Jackie Robinson first played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. It's also the birthday of Leonardo da Vinci, author Henry James, the girl who plays Hermione in the Harry Potter movies, and my brother Theo. I used to be jealous of Theo's birthday. On mine, December 21st, the most impressive thing that happened was the explosion of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie in 1988. Frank Zappa was born on my birthday, but honestly, that doesn't compare to Da Vinci, does it? Plus, my birthday is on the shortest day of the year. I've always felt like I've gotten shafted. Probably Frank Zappa did, too. Today, though, I was not jealous of Theo's birthday. In fact, I couldn't wait to give him the present I'd been keeping for him. Oliver says that, at the courthouse, Theo and I will both have a chance to talk. Apparently, it's not enough for the jury to know, as the medical examiner testified, that Jess's facial bruises were caused by a basilar skull fracture in the periorbital region, blood dissecting along fascial planes and creating the appearance of contusion. Or in other words, what looked like a girl who was beaten might very well have been a girl who simply fell down and hit her head. Apparently, the jury and the judge need to hear Theo and me explain the exact same thing in different words. I guess I'm not the only one who doesn't always understand what's been said. My mother is driving, with Oliver in the passenger seat, and I'm in the back with Theo. My father is at our house, in case the court happens to call in the 20 minutes it takes for us to get there in person. Every time the car goes over a frost heave, it makes me think of jumping on a mattress, something Theo and I used to do together when we were little. We used to believe that if we got enough bounce going, we could reach the ceiling. But I don't think we ever did. After all those years of Theo sticking up for me, I finally got to be the big brother. I did the right thing. I don't know why that's so difficult for these jurors to comprehend. Theo opens his fist. Inside it is the pink iPod that used to be Jess's. From his pocket, he takes out a white tangle of wires, his earbuds. He sticks them in his ears. To all of those experts who said that because I have Asperger's, I can't empathize, so there. People who can't empathize surely don't try to protect the people they love, even if it means having to go to court. Suddenly, Theo pulls one of the earbuds out and offers it to me. Listen, he says, and I do. Jess's music is a piano concerto that swirls behind my eyes. I bend my head toward my brother so that the wires reach, so that, for the rest of the journey, we stay connected. Case 11. My Brother's Keeper. Theo Hunt had been engaging in risky behavior. His Peeping Tom excursions had escalated into entering empty homes and taking souvenirs, electronic games, and MP3 devices. On the afternoon of January 12, 2010, he entered the home of a local college professor. Unbeknownst to him, the house sitter, graduate student Jess Ogilvie, was upstairs showering. He made himself a cup of tea and then heard noises overhead and went to investigate. It's hard to know who was more surprised, Ogilvie, who found a strange boy in her bathroom while she was stark naked, or Theo Hunt, who realized that he knew the girl in the shower, who tutored his older brother Jacob. Ogilvy reached for a towel and exited the stall, but she stumbled, striking her head on the edge of the sink. As she struggled to her feet again, Theo Hunt ran, overturning the CD rack, several stools, and the mail on the counter during his speedy exit. 2 hours later, Theo's brother Jacob arrived for his weekly tutoring session. A student of forensic science, he was surprised to notice a familiar footprint on the porch, the Vans sneaker tread that matched a pair belonging to his brother. Upon entering the unlocked house, Jacob found it in disarray. He called out, but received no answer. Further investigation upstairs led to the discovery of Jess Ogilvy lying naked in a pool of blood. Making the assumption that his brother was involved in her death, possibly during an altercation in the midst of a botched robbery, Jacob proceeded to alter the crime scene so that it would point away from Theo. He cleaned up and dressed the body and moved it downstairs, stumbling once on the staircase, which resulted in Ogilvy's front tooth being knocked out post-mortem. Using bleach, he cleaned up the bathroom to remove blood evidence. He picked up the overturned furniture and CDs and mail and proceeded to create a crime scene that might have been interpreted by authorities at first glance as a kidnapping, and at second glance as a cover-up perpetrated by Ogilvy's stupid jerk of a boyfriend, Mark McGuire. In order to do this, Hunt had to put himself in the mind of a borderline idiot who might attempt, poorly, to make a murder scene look like a kidnapping. He packed some of Ogilvy's clothes and toiletries in a backpack, but made sure that they were not clothes routinely worn by Ogilvy, which someone less astute, like Mark McGuire, would never have realized. He left a typed note, allegedly from Ogilvy herself, asking for the mail to be temporarily stopped, as if she had decided to take a trip. He then cut the screen in the kitchen with a butcher knife, a red herring for forced entry. Finally, he walked below this screen outside, wearing Mark McGuire's boots, so that the police could trace this cover-up back to Ogilvy's boyfriend. Then, Hunt carried Ogilvy's body to a culvert several hundred yards from the house, and waited for investigators to piece together the information he'd left them. Jacob Hunt neglected to realize at the time that he might be implicating himself in the murder. He neglected to consider that the scene he'd come across, at worst, murder at his brother's hand, and at best, a death accidentally caused by Theo, might instead be a death by natural causes, a slippery floor, a skull fracture, and a hematoma. None of this, however, really matters. In the years afterward, Jacob's motive for restructuring the crime scene and moving the body was hotly debated. Some felt that, as there can be crimes of passion, there can be crime scenes of brotherly love. Others felt that Jacob's fixation on forensic science came into play. He wanted to experience the thrill a murderer might feel, waiting for the authorities to figure out the trail he'd left behind. Think whatever you want. The only thing that really matters is this. I'd do it all over again.
The End. You've been listening to House Rules by Jodi Picoult, narrated by Nicole Poole as the voice of Emma, Andy Paris as Theo, Mark Turetsky as Jacob, Rich Orlow as Rich, and Christopher Evan Welch as Oliver. Case material was also read by Mark Turetsky. This recording of House Rules was directed by Rob Granis. This book is copyrighted 2010 by Jodi Picoult. This recording is copyrighted 2010 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Among Thieves by David Hosp, narrated by George Guidel. In 1990, $300 million worth of paintings were stolen from Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in what remains one of the greatest unsolved art thefts of the 20th century. Now, nearly 20 years later, the case threatens to break wide open. Members of Boston's criminal underground are turning up dead. But these are no ordinary murders. The M.O. of the attack suggests the involvement of someone trained by the IRA. But when Scott Finn learns that one of his clients, Devin Malley, was part of the heist, he's quickly drawn into the crossfire and into the renewed hunt for the missing artwork, a hunt that may cost Finn and his colleagues their lives. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.